By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, I'll be speaking to banking team members Donald Robertson in New York and Lev Dorf in Dubai about a couple of topics in the news. Donald will talk about the SEC's proposed rules for centrally clearing more secondary trades involving treasuries, and Lev will explain how the recently renewed military conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia could affect banks in those countries. Later, my co-host Michael Porta will talk to Head of DeFi and Digital Assets Strategy Rajiv Bamra and to banking team analyst Sadia Nabi, both of them are in New York, about proposed regulation of crypto assets, including stablecoins and cryptocurrencies globally and in the U.S. Michael, hi. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Danielle. Glad to be on the program.
So, Michael, you and Rajiv and Sadia have the big job of decrypting what's going on worldwide with crypto asset regulation, which is a lot. What are some of the highlights?
Yes, Rajiv and Sadia have been busy working on tails on the crypto space. Rajiv, in particular, wrote a broad report looking at global proposals for regulating crypto assets. Those include cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ether, as well as stablecoins. Stablecoins, as the name signifies, are designed to have a stable price, which makes them more useful and reliable as an everyday medium of exchange than more volatile cryptocurrencies.
Although sometimes stablecoin prices haven't been so stable.
Right. Most prominently, early this year, prices for the stablecoin Terra proved not so firm. And Rajiv and Sadia will get into why that was.
And I guess that's one of the things regulation could help address. What's Sadia's report about?
Sadia's report is focused more narrowly on proposed regulation of stablecoins in the US specifically.
Got it. I am really looking forward to your discussion with the two of them. But first, it's time for Fast Finance, where Moody's analytic team gives its credit views on topics in the news. Joining me now from New York is banking team associate managing director Donald Robertson, here to talk about a proposal from the SEC to centrally clear more secondary market trades in treasuries. Donald, hi. Welcome back to Focus on Finance.
Thanks, Danielle. It's great to be back.
So before we get to the SEC's proposal to centrally clear more secondary market treasury trades, let's just stipulate that as of now, most secondary trading in treasuries is not centrally cleared. Is that right?
Yes, Danielle, that's right. And this is really why the SEC wants to essentially mandate that more of these transactions are centrally cleared. And this is arguably the single most important asset class in the world. And what's remarkable is that even regulators like the SEC don't really know exactly what the magnitude of transactions that are occurring outside of central clearing is. So in its proposed rule, the SEC makes reference to a number of research sources that estimate where cash and repo treasury transactions are taking place. But the numbers in some cases are still quite vague. One of these sources, for example, suggests that around 68% of the overall dollar value of cash market transactions in treasuries are not centrally cleared. And the SEC considers that this is bringing incremental risk into the US financial system because these markets they're not as transparent as centrally cleared markets, and the risk management practices of the market participants may not be as rigorous or as consistently applied.
Okay, thanks. And there have been some episodes, though, that highlighted that the treasuries market, as safe as it might seem, could actually be a source of systemic risk in certain conditions, right? What were some of those episodes?
Yeah, that's right, Danielle. I mean, on the face of it, U.S. treasuries are a relatively simple asset class, you know, being backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. But the size of the market is extremely large and the volume of transactions is extremely high. And the SEC cited three cases that generally involve dramatic increases in market price volatility and or sharp decreases in the available liquidity. And these were the so-called flash rally of 2014, the repo market stress that occurred in September 2019, and the COVID-19 shock in March 2020.
So what did the SEC say about all three cases?
Yeah, so basically the SEC said that these episodes have raised questions about the US Treasury market's continued capacity to absorb shocks and what factors may be limiting the resilience of the market under stress. So it did acknowledge that its proposed rule would not by itself necessarily prevent future issues like these, but that it would at least reduce counterparty credit risk and improve transparency.
Right. Now, on to the SEC's proposal. What exactly are they proposing? And also just to clarify for listeners, this has nothing to do with auctions of treasuries or anything in the primary market, right? This is all about secondary trading?
Yeah, that's correct. Just the secondary markets and not the primary market in which treasuries are initially sold. You know, that's dealt with transparently by a group of primary dealers. Now, the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation's Government Securities Division is the sole clearing agency that centrally clears these secondary market transactions. Central clearing is generally a good risk mitigant for the financial system. And this is because, you know, there's a central party that aligns itself in between the buyers and sellers in the market and ensures that each party has the necessary resources to complete its side of the trade. And we know that the transacting parties must post margin and meet all sorts of standard risk management hurdles overseen by the clearinghouse in order to do this.
So just to be clear, what are the current rules around clearing?
Sure. So currently, transactions in treasuries that involve clearing members as both the buyer and the seller must be centrally cleared. So what the SEC is proposing is that the rules should be expanded such that trades that involve a clearing member on one side and a non-member on the other side must also be centrally cleared. And this will bring these non-members into the spotlight of the clearinghouse and subject to the clearinghouse's risk oversight and requirements. And this would be quite a big change in how the US financial markets operate.
Got it. Donald, thanks so much for that. And we're now joined by Lev Dorf in Dubai here to talk about the renewed conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia and what that means for banks in those countries. Lev, hi.
Hi, Danielle. Good to be here.
Lev, the Nagorno-Karabakh region has been a point of contention between Azerbaijan and Armenia for decades. It's within the internationally recognized borders of Azerbaijan, but has been largely controlled, I think, by Armenia for a long time. And there's been fighting on and off that has recently started up again, becoming its most intense since 2020. What does that mean for banks in each country?
Right. It's a decades-old conflict between two countries, and a fighting did escalate again in the middle of September. And we understand that a near-term resolution is unlikely despite the fact that a ceasefire agreement has been recently negotiated. While it's not our baseline scenario, a renewed escalation, especially into a large-scale military conflict, would likely hamper both countries' economic activity. It will definitely diminish consumer confidence, disrupt trade, reduce foreign investments, and exert pressure on local currencies. In other words, the operating environments for banks would materially deteriorate in case of a large-scale and a long-lasting military conflict, which would increase banks' liquidity and asset risk, threatening the stability of banking sectors. Also, a political crisis and potential civil unrest in Armenia could also be a source of additional challenge for the operating environment, posing a social risk for banks.
Got it. So given all that, what if any mitigating factors are there for each system?
There are mitigating factors that would help both systems to withstand immediate pressure. For example, Armenian and Azerbaijani banks maintain ample liquidity, mitigating deposit volatility risk. Also, their capital adequacy levels are well above minimum regulatory requirements, which would mitigate asset quality pressure. I need to mention that The central banks of both countries are also ready to provide liquidity support for banks in case of need. And finally, we expect currency risk to be limited for both countries, considering the Armenian dram's material appreciation since February, and the Azerbaijani manat, which has been stable over the past 3 years, will remain supported by high oil prices and substantial foreign currency reserves. And this is important because high dollarization in both banking systems poses additional risk in case of local currency depreciation.
Lev, thank you so much. And we're now joined by my co-host Michael Porta here to talk to Rajiv Bhamra and Sadia Nabi about regulation of crypto assets, including stablecoins.
Thanks, Danielle. Rajiv and Sadia, welcome to the program. Rajiv, let's start with you. Your report on crypto asset regulation is global in scope, covering not only the US, Europe, but also Asia. It covers regulation of both stablecoins and cryptocurrencies, correct?
Yes. So in recent months, as financial distress in the crypto economy has intensified, several policymakers, legislators, and standard-setting organizations from around the world have released draft proposals. These proposals serve as a guidance of what the potential regulatory framework for crypto assets would entail. Given the range of proposed crypto legislations, in our opinion, the laws that ultimately pass would need to be more harmonized in their final scope.
Okay. And staying with the large picture here, most listeners will probably hear the term crypto assets and think of an unregulated space very much separate and apart from regulated banking and finance. So what are the main purposes and benefits of regulation of crypto assets in your view?
So one thing to understand is that managing crypto asset risks without slowing innovation is a challenging issue for regulators. It will be crucial to create global consistency in regulatory and supervisory frameworks as regulators throughout the world strive to strike the right balance for a creative, streamlined regulatory framework. Consumers will be protected while enabling potential benefits from the crypto industry to be realized by creating a transparent regulatory and oversight framework that has the potential to stop fraudulent activity within the cryptocurrency ecosystem, provide businesses with clear guidelines so they can innovate there, and ensure the industry doesn't become a source of financial instability.
Okay, so you laid out a number of benefits there and important goals. Focusing in a bit on market instability, I think a lot of listeners might be wondering about what happened with the algorithmic stablecoin Terra a few months ago. Sadia will get into more about that later, including explaining the different kinds of stablecoins. But the goal in getting this right is to help crypto assets fulfill their promise, right? Like making payments more efficient and cheaper.
So as I indicated earlier, regulators have this difficult challenge of fostering an atmosphere that is fair and equitable in order to encourage innovation. In fact, two more primary goals of crypto legislation are probably to give people more easy access to financial services and ensure that society benefits from increased technological efficiency.
Oh, so let's seize on that last point. So it sounds like one key benefit of regulation is that it would likely eliminate inefficiencies in the crypto sector.
That is correct. And while it is true that in the absence of regulation, crypto assets have a competitive advantage, a regulatory framework will reveal that crypto assets are in fact more efficient. For instance, adopting a stablecoin-specific legal framework would almost certainly have advantages beyond their current use, since they have a distinct potential for increasing speed and efficiency at a reduced cost for payments.
Got it. So we've talked a bit about what the benefits of regulation will be, in particular, increasing efficiency of the crypto asset space. So let's get into the specifics of regulation currently in place. As we mentioned, it's happening across the globe, but maybe we could start with the US.
So I would say it all started with President Biden's executive order issued on March 9th, which provided the first comprehensive government strategy for addressing the risks and maximizing the potential benefits of digital assets and the underlying technologies. Agencies from throughout the government have collaborated over the past 6 months to establish frameworks, policy recommendations, and legislative proposals for financial inclusion, responsible innovation, fighting illicit money, supporting financial stability and also safeguarding investors and consumers. However, no specific legislation has been passed yet.
So a lot of activity over the last 6 months in the U.S. at the executive level, in the legislative branch and across agencies, but nothing formal as yet. And I understand there's a lot of activity in Europe as well, pretty much across the board.
That is correct. And in fact, Europe is probably a step ahead, with the European Union having reached an initial agreement on a set of regulatory proposals for markets and crypto assets. Its primary goal is to increase regulatory certainty, harmonize the EU market, protect consumers, and improve financial stability. Furthermore, the European Union has taken a conservative approach to cryptocurrency anti-money laundering legislation, requiring cryptocurrency exchanges to collect information and personal data on all cryptocurrency transfers, regardless of size, and to provide that information to authorities upon request.
Yeah, so you mentioned the EU has taken a conservative approach to cryptocurrency anti-money laundering legislation. When you cover Asia-Pac in your report, you mention there's a variety of approaches there, but you do say that China is maybe even more conservative than, say, the EU is on banning everything crypto.
That is accurate. You mentioned China, but the Reserve Bank of India has also expressed resistance to cryptocurrencies. Singapore, on the other hand, has adopted a more cautious approach, and Japan has built a new legal framework to increase investor safeguards and tighten current anti-money laundering legislation, enabling the system to track stablecoin movement.
Rajiv, thanks for that very helpful overview. And now we'll turn to Sadia for more about regulation of stablecoins in the US specifically. Sadia, maybe we can start with a little bit of background. It was partly market-shaking events around a particular stablecoin, Terra, that really accelerated efforts among governments and standard setters to regulate crypto assets. Could you give a little background on that?
I think the efforts to regulate crypto assets have been taking shape for a while. And as we saw, President Biden signed the executive order on ensuring responsible development of digital assets early this year in March, which highlighted this. But you're correct that the disruption caused by the Terra crash certainly emphasized the importance that regulation can play in protecting investors.
Right. And Terra, as mentioned, is a stablecoin. What does that mean in practical terms? How does it differ from a cryptocurrency more broadly?
Good question. Well, stablecoin is a type of cryptocurrency. Stablecoins are designed to be digital assets or cryptocurrencies whose price is pegged to that of another asset or basket of assets. The key feature of a stablecoin is the linkage to a stable store of value, which is supposed to make it an efficient means of digital payment, potentially for everyday use. For example, a United States dollar denominated stablecoin, let's call it a USD coin, is typically linked to a US dollar asset, which means that the value of one USD stablecoin would be $1.
All right. So stablecoins are for everyday use in transactions, as I understand it, a medium of exchange, whereas cryptocurrencies more broadly can be used for investment and trading. Without getting into too much technical detail, maybe we can dig in a little bit further on what happened with Terra earlier this year.
Good question. So as I mentioned earlier, a stablecoin's value is pegged to another asset. The peg is usually maintained by holding reserve assets backing the stablecoin. However, not all stablecoins are reserve-backed. Some stablecoins use an algorithm to maintain a stable value. Although about half of the top 10 stablecoins by volume as of June 30th, 2022 were algorithmic stablecoins, they represented a small portion only, about 6% of overall outstanding volume.
Okay. Terra is one of the algorithmic stablecoins, right? And you mentioned that these make up only 6% of outstanding volume. So how did Terra become the root of so much market turmoil?
You're absolutely correct. Terra is an algorithmic stablecoin, which means that it uses a protocol which is supposed to maintain its one-on-one peg to the US dollar. There are a number of problems in the Terra algorithm, one of which is that it's linked to Terra's own native cryptocurrency token called Luna. Another problem is that Terra relies on independent traders to perform an essential price stabilizing arbitrage function. This proved to ultimately be a core weakness of the Terra algorithm. The algorithm could work only if there was sufficient demand for both Luna and Terra stablecoin. Terra saw exponential growth when Anchor, a separate protocol altogether, started offering 20% returns on Terra stablecoins. As you can imagine, these yields proved to be unsustainable for Anchor, and the resulting collapse, along with volatility in the crypto markets, decreased demand for Terra, increased supply of Luna due to its linkages in Terra, and with supply outpacing demand, the prices of both tokens dropped and billions of dollars were lost.
Right. So Anchor actually unanchored Terra and reduced the firmness in prices of the stablecoin. Very interesting. With that background, what would be the benefits of regulating stablecoins? How would that help avoid some of these issues?
Well, there are a number of benefits of regulation. Given that there is a lack of clear ground rules at the moment, there is no guarantee that the value of a stablecoin is indeed stable relative to the value of reference assets. Certainly, rules regarding disclosure or how reserves backing stablecoins can be invested will go a long way to protect investors. So increasing oversight of stablecoins would increase their safety, increase their transparency, and help limit risks to financial stability. Regulation would also allow banks to enter the space and develop stablecoin products and capabilities.
Right. So investor protections, enhanced safety and transparency, both of which would lower risk to financial stability. Any other prospective benefits for how the finance system operates? And you mentioned banks might get involved. How would that happen in a regulated market?
Okay, so it could increase acceptance of digital currency payment systems and also encourage technological advances, which would also benefit the broader economy if costs decline and speed of payments and acceptance increases. One benefit of a bank-issued stablecoin is that banks are better positioned to address the consumer protection and regulatory concerns that have been raised in connection with non-bank-issued stablecoins, including the ability to verify the level of collateral reserves that these stablecoins maintain. The alternative financial system that has grown around the rising volume of digital payments, transfers, and lending activities lack the strong regulation and risk management frameworks of traditional banking system and payment systems, which protect customers, limit illicit activities, and control systemic risk.
Okay, so banks have more experience with some of these key things you mentioned, like consumer protections and regulatory concerns. Moving along, maybe we could get into a little more detail on how stablecoins could support more efficient payments.
So stablecoins could also be used by individuals and institutions to send and receive payments in real time, providing faster and cheaper money movement, particularly with respect to cross-border transfers. Historically, transferring money across borders has oftentimes been a complex, expensive, multi-step process that usually takes several days to complete, in part to verify the recipient's account information and confirm that there are sufficient funds in the sender's account. Even with technological advances, such as the development of real-time payments, most domestic dollar payments currently are not instantaneous or even same day. Although payments can be settled between financial institutions the same day, for individual customers, the settlement can take as long as 3 to 5 business days domestically, and even longer for international transfers. The decentralized setup of blockchain networks eliminates the reliance on intermediaries, such as a bank, and improves the accuracy and efficiency of data verification. This would be especially valuable for international transfers, which tend to take longer and are more expensive. Additionally, on the blockchain, transaction fees are a small fraction of the amount being transferred and can be much cheaper than conventional costs of transferring money.
So, Sadia, I'm just wondering, would regulation of stablecoins in this way make them lose part of their appeal? Meaning, if they become subject to know your customer rules, anti-money laundering rules, and other types of regulation, does that kind of re-centralize them in a way?
Not necessarily. The underlying technology, which is key for realizing efficiency, doesn't get impacted. In fact, regulatory clarity and greater acceptance of stablecoins would likely encourage further investment in technological advances. But it's also important to recognize that innovation in decentralized finance thrive precisely because of the lack of regulation in this space, right? Development and advancements were fast and carefree. But as we've seen, it has also led to a lot of risk with untested and unproven systems. So regulation might discourage newer entrants. So I think introducing regulation will be a balancing act between harmonizing rules among different regions, improving safety and soundness, but also making sure that innovation is not stifled.
Right. That's a balancing act that Rajiv also was referring to a little bit earlier in our conversation. Sadia, Rajiv, Michael, Donald, and Lev, thank you all very much for your insights. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To read any of the reports referenced in this episode, you can click the link for this episode at moodys.com/podcasts. And please tune in again for future episodes of Focus on Finance.
Thanks for listening to this Moody's Talks podcast. To find out more about the topics discussed, please follow the links in the show notes. You can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts by visiting moodys.com/podcasts.